Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have a very special show. I believe Stephen Sondheim and his collaborator, John Wideman, to have written a really great trilogy of musicals about America. Those three are Pacific Overtures, Assassins, and now at last in a final form, Roadshow. Roadshow began with a book about the Meisner brothers called The Legendary Meisners. It became a musical which worked through in workshops called Wise Guys, became a musical called Bounce when it was first recorded, and now it is Roadshow. A recording of Roadshow was recently released on Nonesuch PS Classics. And when I heard it, by the end of the record, I was kind of shivering. Now, this was Los Angeles, so believe me, it wasn't cold out. It was that somehow they'd touched a certain vein about the nightmare of American optimism, what you might call American perpetual motion, the idea that it goes on, and that you can't change it, that not even death brings it to a close. Now, I'm curious, how did this start? I believe you had read The Legendary Meisners, Steve, and my guests, by the way, are Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman, the collaborators, and I'm very, very honored to have them here.
Well, I read it when I was 22 years old. It was a couple of articles in New Yorker magazine, and then they were expanded by Alva Johnston, who wrote them into a book. And I read the book, and I thought it would make a terrific musical. I got fascinated by the character of Wilson Meisner, who was a jack of all trades and perhaps a master of none, but the restlessness and the fact that he never found a center for his energies and his talents fascinated me. And I wanted to buy an option on it, take an option on it. So I saved. I was working in television, writing a series called Topper in California. And after 5 months, I had enough money to rent an apartment and some money left over to, I hope, take an option. And I got back to New York and found out that an option had already been taken on it by, of all people, David Merrick, who was sort of the most notorious Broadway producer of the time. And it was to be written by S.N. Behrman, a very well-known playwright who had not written a musical before, and a score by Irving Berlin, and was to star Bob Hope. A number of years later, I was working on Gypsy, and David Merrick was the producer. I asked him what had ever happened to that Meisner musical, and he said, oh, we gave it up. Behrman wrote about five scenes, and Berlin wrote half a dozen songs, and it just didn't work out. So I thought, ooh. So I immediately looked into the rights again. And I tried to interest, over the years, a number of producers in it and couldn't, or rather didn't. And then many years passed, and I wrote two shows with John Wideman and mentioned it to him, and he got interested in it. But it was another aspect of the story that interested him, so he can tell you what interested him. It wasn't Wilson's character as much as it was Addison's.
Steve called me, I guess, right after he had written Passion. And he said he didn't want to write another gloomy musical. And had I ever heard of a guy named Wilson Meisner? And I said, I hadn't. But, and Steve said, well, there's his book. Would you be willing to? I said, yeah. So I got a copy of the book and read it. And my response to Wilson, as he's characterized in the book, was completely different from Steve's. He struck me as a selfish, self-involved SOB, And at the same time, I thought his relationship with his brother was interesting. He had a brother named Addison who had took sort of a different path through life, but one which kept him partnered with his brother much of the time. But Addison had very different ambitions and creative ambitions. He was a genuine artist. And in the end, his brother really, Wilson, after sort of bringing down everybody else he'd been involved with, looked around. There was nobody else to bring down. And so he brought his brother down. That interested me. And but honestly, as much as anything else, it was the period of time against which these two guys lived their lives that I found fascinating. I mean, their lives, for all intents and purposes, began with the gold rush in the Yukon in 1895 and ended with the land rush in Florida in the 1920s, a land rush that turned into a bust and really was a rehearsal for the market crash of a few years later. And in the meantime, they had sort of crisscrossed the country, always on the move, trying a variety of different things, Wilson more than Addison. But it seemed like these seemed like two emblematic American lives. And if we could figure out what it was that was really emblematic about them, there was a great story there. And given what we finally figured out and given where we landed on Roadshow, I'm afraid that Steve's desire not to write another gloomy show went by the boards.
Well, oh, I don't think it's gloomy.
It's not exactly gloomy, but it is bleak.
That's different. That's quite different.
Yes, fair enough.
That's
right.
And it's bright and bleak.
Bright and bleak, exactly.
Bright and bleak.
The thing that is amazing that makes Roadshow a musical for our time and maybe not the time when you discovered the book is that mysteriously, when you look at it carefully, the musical is structured as a series of very rapidly maneuvered, slippery pyramid or Ponzi schemes. So the mood of the musical is very much that of the dexterity which we see today has not only destroyed our economy, but destroyed our faith in one another, our ability to trust anything. Now, perhaps we needed to be a people whose gullibility got an overhaul. But somehow or other, this is the musical of our desperate times, it strikes me. And the songs are shaped, I call them houses that Jack built, but they take a form that you've been working on since Pretty Little Picture. It's a growing crystal form.
All MacDonald.
Yes. Yeah. How, in the course of this, it seems that the material has been stripped down for ultimate swiftness so that we can watch the speed with which things self-destruct.
That's very shrewd of you because actually, I think I should say to the listeners that it took us, that we wrote this show over a period of 14 years. We did not write steadily for 14 years, but the first draft was finished in 1994 and the show didn't get produced until 2008. Roadshow, that is to say, Bounce got produced a few years earlier. But the final shape and the swiftness of the final shape is very much due to the influence of our director of Roadshow, John Doyle, who, on reading the script, urged John and me to cut out as much extraneous material, including transitions between scenes, as possible to give it exactly the spring-like tension and swiftness that you speak about. Do you agree, John?
Yeah, and before John got his hands on it, it had wound up on the desk of Oscar Eustace at the Public. And Oscar had really taken us through the first stage of refocusing the material. Oscar felt very strongly that the show still was a kind of a mix of tones and styles, and that what we needed to do was to focus on the serious purpose that underlay the story. The three iterations of the show, the first one that we did downtown at the New York Theater Workshop, then Bounce, which we did with Hal Prince at the Goodman in Chicago and at the Kennedy Center, and then Roadshow at the Public, have a very similar structure in terms of the storytelling. The characters are the same with the exception of a female character who was added to Bounce. But they are, in terms of their intention, they are wildly different shows. And
it was
as I said, first with the help of Oscar and then I think with and then John, that we were nudged in the direction of finally creating a roadshow, a musical about the Meisners called Roadshow, which, as you say, is a companion piece to Pacific Overtures and Assassins, and I think makes a collection of pieces about America that fit comfortably together, which would not have been true of any of the earlier versions of the show.
It's true. Oscar focused us, and John by oversimplifying, I'll say it. Oscar focused us on the subject matter, and John on the style.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Stephen Sondheim and John Weidman about their musical Roadshow. A recording of Roadshow was recently released on Nonesuch PS Classics. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Stephen Sondheim and John Weidman about their musical Roadshow. Now, what I noticed was that in Wise Guys began with a sort of medley of songs that Addison and Wilson sang together. Bounce began with one song that they sing together. Roadshow, fascinatingly, comes to the understanding that these guys would never sing together, that their voices in harmony are an unimaginable thing. And what's more, at the heart of the show, there's a song between Wilson and another man, not his brother. It's a love song between two men.
You mean Addison? Addison.
Excuse me, Addison. And what is his friend's name?
Hollis.
They're singing together what I think is a first for a semi-traditional Broadway musical, a love song between two men.
Well, Lacage had that too, I think.
But there, Lacage, that was the subject.
Yeah, right.
This arrives at something with difficulty.
Oh, yeah.
First, there's cocktails at the Cosdens.
Oh, Jesus.
Hun, we've got fish to fry.
Why don't you do this one without me, huh?
Then there's dinner at the Dodges, the reception at the Roosevelt.
I think I'm gonna die.
And every party filled with millionaires who want to build the biggest villa since the days of ancient Rome. So what do you say we just stay home? The best thing that ever has happened to me, you are. Okay then, one of the best things that's happened to me, you are. They say we all find love. I never bought it. I never thought it would happen to me. Who could foresee? You are the goddamnedest thing that has happened to me ever. When did I have this much happiness happen to me? Never. I can't believe my luck. I can do is be the best thing that's happened to you. So what do you say we just stay home? What do you say we just go out on the boat and get smashed and make love on the beach and stare up at the moon?
Holly,
you might just be the best thing that has happened to me so far. Of course, not much ever really has happened to me so far. I didn't much like love. I always fought it. I never thought it would happen like this.
Give us a kiss.
We may just be the best thing that has happened to us, kiddo,
partner.
Another moment like this may not happen to us, partner,
lover.
When all is said and done, I have to agree. You are the best thing that's happened to me. Who knew?
Who dreamed?
Beats me.
Well, you see, I think that this is one of the big discoveries of the Sondheim musical, and I don't think anyone has ever really pointed to it. The question being, who sings? Who can sing with who? For the beginning, I don't know how long of Gypsy, except for the timid voices of two little girls, all you hear is Rose's voice. Mm-hmm. It's one monologue after another, and even in a duet with Herbie, she's drowning him out as he explains that he can neither sing nor dance. And she is saying, "You'll never get away from me," a terrifying impulse. The next indication that I had of this was when you said that Do I Hear a Waltz shouldn't be a musical, because you can't make a musical about a person whose essential nature...
Well, no, actually, what I said was everybody should sing except Leona, because it's about a woman who metaphorically can't sing until the very end of the show, at which point she would sing, and then you would understand what the... to use that dreadful word that's all too common these days and talking about her journey, as actors like to say, her journey would be towards the moment when she can sing. Then it would have made sense, and I would love to have done that, but Richard Rodgers would have none of it.
And the discovery in Sweeney Todd that although Sweeney and Mrs. Lovett will sing together, their harmonies are extremely bizarre, and that they're always singing at something like cross purposes. Add to this the description of character in song that complicated rhymes and multisyllabics are the province of intelligent
or educated.
Educated characters. You begin to get a whole sense of how to musicalize character. And I think that in Roadshow, much of what's done in this show is done entirely in the choice of the kind of song, who's singing with who, whether they sing together or apart, and who can finally, even for a brief section of time, fit together. Because immediately after this love song, Wilson comes back and essentially seduces Hollis, and suddenly it's what we can do together.
That's correct.
Absolutely right.
This is a across-the-board lack of faith in human unions and continuities, yes?
Well, I don't know about that. It's interesting, though, that at one point we had a a trio between Wilson and Addison and Hollis in which you actually saw what you just described happen. It was in our vaudeville days, you know, the original Wise Guys was conceived as a sort of Hope and Crosby road movie of vaudeville, and partly justified by the fact that John discovered that vaudeville was sort of born and died in the same years that the Meisners were born and died, and which turned out to be a very useful coincidence. And that's when you spoke about the medley of four songs. Of course, they were done in vaudeville style. And that aspect played into a number of scenes that we would interrupt the story to have these little vaudeville interludes. And one of them was a trio in which you saw Wilson seduce Hollis away from Addison. So I'm just, that's a footnote to what you just said.
I mean, it was an earmark of what we were struggling with, I think, in that first expression of the show, that the first conversations we had started with the notion of a kind of a Hope Crosby relationship between these two guys, which I thought was fascinating, and I thought if you could write a show which felt like a Hope Crosby musical, but which had a serious purpose, sort of the road to ruin as opposed to the road to Morocco, you'd have something extraordinary. As a practical matter, it turned out to be really undoable for all kinds of reasons that I could make a list. But that's what we were, one of the things we were discovering when we were down at the New York Theatre Workshop.
Well, one of the things that I notice is that it's a peeling back of ingenuities. You know, the idea of doing a show as a vaudeville show or as a road to movie, it would have been ingenious, but what comes in Roadshow is emotionally very intense. It's cloaked only by ambivalence, but it's a very dark interplay between characters, and it's made, it seems to me, brilliantly out of the intersection of where is song, where is dialogue.
Well, that was the essential change between Bounce and Roadshow, was that's what you call the darkening. Bounce was deliberately bouncy, and Roadshow is deliberately solider.
Let's talk about that darkness. For one thing, musical comedy itself is thought as an art form to be involved in a war between commerce and art. Are those things necessarily at odds with one another?
I think, and then Steve, dive in here. I think they are more and more and more at odds with one another. And I think really the only home for musicals that have a serious artistic ambition at this point are at not-for-profit theaters. And that if something in that venue makes a splash, like Spring Awakening, then it may get picked up and it may be moved and have some kind of a commercial life. But, these shows, except for Pacific Overtures, which is from a different era, began life at not-for-profits, and I think that – and have continued to have lives.
Not a coincidence.
At not-for-profits, you know, yeah.
Not a coincidence.
It seems to me that part of the ambivalence and bleakness is an interest in truth-telling, and that people don't feel very comfortable with the truth. They don't like it in songs, and musical comedy songs were at one time famous for asking you to look for the silver lining, and it was fairly deeply sophisticated people who were advising this search. So there's a tendency to like musicals for the shallow optimism of their prescriptions.
Of course, no. Truth, people look for truth, or used to anyway, in straight plays, and in they still do in novels and things like that. They just have never looked for truth in musicals until actually it started with Oscar, with Showboat, started to say, you know, a musical can actually be about something. It doesn't, and it can still be entertaining. And so, and from then on, the history of musicals changed a bit. But sure, the people essentially go to musicals. Just the word itself suggests song and dance, suggests entertainment in its lightest and most mindless and soothing and exhilarating form.
I've been talking to Stephen Sondheim and John Weidman, the collaborators on Roadshow. You know, I have intentionally not listed the achievements of Mr. Sondheim, West Side Story, Gypsy, A Funny Thing Happened, Anyone Can Whistle, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, etc., until the end of the show, because I wanted to focus on these three shows, and I think it's unfair that these things are always put into comparison with things in the past, because I think that these three are vital, interesting, new shows. I would like to see them in tandem with one another. Mm-hmm. My other guest, John Weidman, wrote the books of these three musicals, as well as the ingenious, it seems to me, adaptation of Anything Goes that appeared a few years back at Lincoln Center. They are both long-standing participants in the traditions of musical theater. Mr. Weidman's father wrote I Can Get a Few Wholesale and Fiorello. And, of course, Stephen Sondheim was mentored by the great Oscar Hammerstein. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojcik at the Carnegie Studios in New York City, and to Bob Weinstein and Annie Clayton for their support and encouragement. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.